Oh, Father, friends, please pray with me. Father in the heavens, oh, I hardly know what to pray. I ask you to strengthen us with might by your Spirit in the inner soul of each of us, that we may be able to wisely manage the treasures you've given us. We commit this meeting into your hands in Yahshua's name. Amen. Hallelujah. Friends, brothers, sisters, correspondents, viewers from afar, I'm Brother Michael Bannock from Fulton, Missouri. May Yahshua's grace be yours in abundance. My remarks today are titled Treasure Chest Theology. Here's an overview of what's coming up. We're going to open with two challenging questions. Then we're going to challenge you with a grim story. All these things are meant to stimulate thought. We're going to explore our treasure chest and how to use our treasure chest effectively. The world uses their treasure chest, and sometimes they use ours. We're going to learn what we can from the world. We're going to talk about your treasure chest and the quest for intimacy. What things can we learn from the Bible? What's your treasure? We're going to talk about treasures in heaven, a lot of focus on that. We're going to talk about financial freedom. We're going to talk more about treasures in heaven. We're going to talk about going for the gold. And then we'll have a summary. Let's start out with a question. I want you to pretend that your only purpose in life, your main trunk of the tree, main thrust purpose in life, was righteousness. To put an end to all the sin in your life. No more sin. No, I don't want anything to do with it. I hate this stuff. I hate what it does to me. I hate what it does to the people around me. I hate the way it corrupts my soul and ruins my day. I don't want any sin. Suppose that was your main thrust priority. Question, how differently would you arrange your life? What risks would you stop taking? Let's remember, righteousness means not only avoiding bad actions, but it also means positive actions, sacred duty, things like that. How would your life be rearranged? You know, I asked this question several times before this Sabbath came along. And one guy in the bunch, I'm looking at him now, one guy in the bunch, he paused and he said, "Hey, didn't we kind of promise that when we got into the faith? This is nothing special, this question number one." But I am convinced this is how Yahshua pulled it off. At a very young age, he said, "No, I don't want any sin at all. This is my priority, my top priority." When you emerged from the waters of baptism, that was your vow. How would you change your life now that I've underlined this? What would you rearrange? Let's go to question number two. I've been asking this a lot lately. If you were wrong about something, who would you trust to tell you about it? I've got quite a bit of silence the last several months. When I brought this question up, one of the elders who was visiting here, I asked him about this. He said, "Well, I trust my wife to tell me." Now, that's a wise man. You know, your spouse is a great source of spiritual counsel. They see things both ways, your wives and your husbands. They see things that maybe you don't see or you don't know about. But who would you trust to tell you? Who has standing in your life? I got one great answer from one brother. He said that in the past, before joining us, he got pretty good results when he would show people what the Bible says. Rather than him going direct with his own words, he'd find where in the Bible his concerns were being played out in some friend or brother's life. Many years ago, I used to ask people, "To whom are you in subjection? To whose authority are you in subjection?" And way too many people told me, "I'm in subjection to Yahshua." Well, it's easy to claim you're in subjection to somebody way out there that you can't see every day. The Bible does say, "Obey them that have rule over you, for they look after your souls." That's why it's so important to have a network, a congregation, a fabric of fellowship. Even from afar, you can make friends with us from afar and get in on it, and to have pastors and elders. Well, I'm going to pivot now to a grim story from the world of airline travel. Excuse me. I guess I'm going to have to get an early jump on my request for water. I forgot to. Somebody could get me a cup of water. I'd appreciate it. This story appeared in a Messianic magazine about 20 years ago. It's a true story. The lady wrote the story in herself. It was about two issues of this magazine. I don't even know if it's still being published. But this lady wrote in her story. You see, about two issues of this magazine were dedicated to the subject of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And this airline stewardess wrote in. She said, I'm a flight attendant. And she met a guy she liked, and she married him. I'm not sure if she met him on the plane or if it was part of her social network. Maybe she met him at a bar. I don't know. And she married this guy. They proceeded to have a beautiful baby. And once they got some momentum on this baby boy they downloaded, he promptly divorced her. Why? Looked like everything was going nice. Now, if this gal is writing into a Messianic magazine, she's in some kind of faith, right? Some kind of faith-based life. Her husband explained as follows. He said, I should now tell you, I'm actually a homosexual. I've always wanted a son. And now that I have a son, there's no more need to be married. That's a pretty sicko story, but it's true. There's two flags that raised when I read this story. I still remember when I read it, my eyes were popping. I do not want my remarks to make it sound like I'm indicting her, all right? But there's a lot of built-in protection in Yahweh's wisdom, Yahweh's ways, Yahweh's laws. There's built-in protection there. There's supernatural protection like we sang about earlier today. It's funny how some of these songs played into my message. But in terms of walking in wisdom, two things jumped out at me. Number one, she's a flight attendant. Now, the scriptures say a woman is to be a keeper at home. If you have a problem with that, you have the problem. Typically, not always, and I know there's counter-trend activity, but usually in Bible economy, Yahweh's economy, the man provides the home, the woman keeps the home. She makes the home. I remember my mother lecturing me. She says, if your wife tells you to move the furniture this way and that, you do it. And if she changes her mind the next day, you do that too for her. You move that furniture around and you make sure your wife's happy with the arrangement of the home because that's her nest. How can a woman be a keeper at home if she's hopscotching around the country as an airline attendant? I'm not saying it's a sin to be an airline attendant, but once you're married, isn't there supposed to be some calibration of our duties? Well, to tell you the truth, it's not clear whether she quit her job upon marriage. But you see, the same thing applies, because if she's an airline attendant, jumping around the world like a kangaroo on a pogo stick, how is she building a network, a fabric, a community in which she can vet this potential husband? Well, there's another flag that jumped out. There's no question that this evil man knew more about her than she knew about him. Oh, he sized her up real good. He got his son, and then she has a broken heart. Question, brother, where is your heart? Where is my heart? Sisters, where is your heart? Where is my heart? This is a heart-based religion. You doubt that? I'll take you to Jeremiah 31:31. That's easy to remember, Jeremiah 31:31. That's where Yahweh describes the new covenant. He will write his laws in our hearts. That image over there, that's a collection of communion cups. I was careful to find an image that doesn't have any religious symbols or anything on it. If you harmonize the accounts of the Last Supper, it looks like Yahshua started with his cup, and he divided it among everybody else's cup. Then he did the bread, and then they drank the cup. So there was several cups involved. Now, we use these little communion cups here. That's all you need. But when you take that cup and the bread, you're entering a covenant. No, you're renewing a covenant where the laws are written on your heart. This is a heart-based religion. And therefore, I feel the authority to talk about it that way. How can we know what's in our hearts? We're going to explore that. Please excuse me there for that drink. Let me pivot to something else. It's pretty well known now that I have a policy operative in my life. Sometimes people will come to you asking for a few dollars to get by. And I think all of us can find $10 and $20 bills for a quick emergency. But my personal policy is that if you get to three digits, if you need three digits worth of money, I've been telling people, your problem is my problem then. If three digits, how did that happen? Three digits? If your problem is my problem, I want to be part of the solution. So I've been saying that I want to see bank statements, credit card statements, utility phone, and loan records. Sounds kind of harsh, doesn't it? But you know, there's ways of getting into trouble in this age that you never had in antiquity. There's mouse clicks, buy now, credit card swipes. Other forms of trouble you can get into today, you could not do in antiquity. There's a brother far from here. Many of you know him, but I won't mention his name. He is legendary with his charitable deeds. When I described this to him, he said, that's crazy. You want 1 year of credit card statements, bank statements, loans, utility bills, and phone bills? Isn't it kind of time-consuming to go through all that? I said, yes, I'm making a commitment to look at this with them. Surely, if their problem is my problem, I want to be part of the solution. And it's a lot of work and time to look at that. Really, what are you blowing your money on? Now, I've got some pushback on this. I might fine-tune it a little bit, but I know I'm onto something. None of these things existed in Yahshua's time. Let's go a little farther. I don't see myself as a marriage counselor, but if I was, the first thing I'd ask that couple is, I want to see you here next week with 1 year of credit card statements, bank statements, loan records, utility bills, and phone bills. Why? Why would I want, oh, for one thing, a significant amount of marital difficulties and arguments are arguments about money, a significant fraction of that. That's well known. But there's more. These records show where the heart is at. And I say that with Yahshua's authority, Matthew 6, 21. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And if I drop dead up here, I want you to remember this slide. These financial instruments show you where your heart is at. And that's where I'm going to poke and prod and challenge you for the remainder of the time that I'm up here. This is where your heart's at. Anything that records where your treasure is. The treasures are indicated in these documents a number of ways. Surely money is a treasure. Time is a treasure. Now let's get something straight. A lot of you are very generous in your conversation with me in the weeks building up to this when I asked about treasure. Of course your grandchildren are a treasure. Of course they are. But I'm talking about treasures that you can invest, that you can place into some space, some environment, and have there be a return over time. I'm not going to invest my kids in something. There might be an exception if your children are part of a family business. But that's not the kind of investment I'm talking about here, and I think you understand that. But these documents surely indicate where your money is going. Yeah, if you go back and look at your credit card from Home Depot and it says, you bought a refrigerator for $2,500. You know, it's kind of looking back at you, and you say, you know, we're going to be paying that for a long time. Other expenses. How about time? Time is a treasure. How would these financial records indicate time? Well, modern cell phone bills indicate time. My cell phone bill shows me who I called, who called me, and how much time we were on the blower together. That means I've invested in that relationship with my time. Let's look at other forums in which we can find out where our treasures are. But first, I don't want you to sneer at this. This is not some crazy, arcane idea. I want you to think about it. We're relaxing on Sabbath, contemplating spiritual realities. Our minds are far from our worldly concerns, hopefully. Hopefully you left your concerns at the front door. Now, there's legitimate things to be praying about here in Yahweh's house. But if you're worried about your golf handicap and you're worried about what kind of wax you're going to put on your car this weekend, leave that at the door. But while we're relaxing here, kind of isolated from our ordinary concerns, there are people right now clawing through the very data that I'm urging you to look at. Fat cats, money men, marketing experts, advertising experts, hucksters, artificial intelligence bots, the whole lot. They're analyzing, clawing through the very data I'm urging you to look at to find out what's in your heart. Where's my heart? Where's it at? That's right. Mr. Global knows more about what's in your heart right now than you know about what's in your heart, because they're clawing through that data. If you've been doing like I've been doing, just look at the bottom line on your credit card statement. Now, I paid a whole thing off every month. But if you just look at the bottom line and don't think about the content, you're losing valuable insights as to how your money is being managed. Don't sneer at this recommendation I'm urging upon you. But there's more treasures. Your time is documented in other places. For example, the internet access. To a certain extent, there's limits there. You know, these modern browsers have multiple tabs. It's common for me to leave a tab open for a week just in case I need to go back to it. So maybe I have a tab open for a tool for my business, an instrument for my laboratory or something. That doesn't mean my heart is wrapped around it because it's been open a long time. But if you're clicking on the same kind of things all the time, that's an indication your heart is there. And there are some internet access things that are time-stamped. There's videos, podcasts, things like that. The orientation of your heart is captured in these records. And as much as I resent Mr. Global having these records, maybe we should be looking at them too. How about the odometer on your car? Now, there's one for me. I have over $300,000 miles on my little Honda out there. Divide that by, let's say, 50 miles an hour. That's 60,000 hours I've been behind that wheel. That's an awful lot of time. So what was it that I was going to or from that meant so much to me that I would put 60,000 hours of time in the car? I got to think about that. What was going on that I wanted to do so much travel? And asking the brethren, I got some real quality inputs when I would ask the saints, hey, could you give me an idea of some treasures you can identify? I got a great one from Brother Rodney. I hope he's doing well. He said, your faith is a treasure. You see, that's something that comes from inside, your faith. Two stories come to mind, the widow's mite, her two mites. And little story involving a renter up in Chicago, I'll tell you about in a minute. But the widow, you'll find a lot of these treasures, they're blended together. And the story of the widow and her mites, she's blending her faith with her finances. Yahshua said she gave everything she had. Man, I'm not there yet. But Yahshua admired her for that. She doesn't know that temple that she contributed to is going to be destroyed in 40 years. She's doing the best she can to support the ministry. In that sense, she was laying up treasures in heaven. We'll talk more about that later. She's blending her faith with her money. Let's talk about a negative kind of faith. I had a guy apply to rent my home up in Chicago years ago. I liked the guy. I hit it off with him. He submitted his application through the rental agency, through the real estate agency, and he was required to attach 3 months' bank statements to verify income. So I opened up the scanned documents. I could see the income there clearly. It seemed to be adequate. But he had also, prior to scanning them, he took a giant Sharpie and he blacked out several entries in his bank statement. And of course, when you do a thing like that, it only raises curiosity. Well, what didn't he want me to see? Like I couldn't figure out what it was, but I did forensically reconstruct it because he blacked out a number of things there. I figured out that he spent several hundred dollars a month on this thing he didn't want me to see. Well, it turns out for several of the entries, he neglected to black out the 800 number. So I called there, and it was the Illinois Lottery Board. Thank you for calling the Illinois Lottery Board. If you have a gambling addiction, please call this other 800 number. Okay. See, he mingled his money with faith in the lottery system. Now, look, there's a lot of people in the outreach here. If some of you out there are into this lottery stuff, you should know that there are people who would say that what you're doing is a tax on the stupid. It's very unwise to throw your money in lottery tickets, especially at the level this guy was. And I was at a point in my life where I couldn't take any financial risks. Guy's blowing all that money on lottery tickets. Heaven help us. What do you put your faith in? Here's another treasure. I was talking to Young Faith. Remember the night we had chicken and waffles? I was talking to Young Faith that night. I said, hey, what kind of treasures do we have? And she gave me a terrific answer. She said, our words are a treasure. Our words, again, come from inside, don't they? The tongue has the power of life and death. We can encourage one another. We could sing to one another. I went to Brother Dan's table during fellowship meal, and they gave me some terrific inputs. Our heritage, words of our heritage, our traditions, our testimonies of how Yahweh's been at work in our life. Those of you who are parents, you should think about how you can establish a legacy within your family, stories of how Yahweh was real to you. These are wonderful. Our religion is based on stories, encouraging stories, uplifting stories. I should add, in there too, you should add how you learned from your failures. Tell you the truth, I'm more interested in knowing how you learn from your failures than anything else. But anything, the whole thing, the whole ball, has got value. There are spiritual gifts that Yahweh has given you, wisdom and insight. These are treasures we can invest in one another. We have a lot of treasures. Some of them are tangible. You can feel them. Some of them are not. We have so many treasures we can get to one another. There are many kinds of treasures. Now, I had a list of them. I failed to grab it by my keys on the way out the door. So I'm going to do what I can from memory to pull out the rest. How about respect? How about respect? We can invest respect in each other. That's so powerful. Certainly love. Love is a treasure. We can invest in each other. How about prepared meals? You know, things happen so fast after services. I never get around to really thanking the ladies who put that food out there. We've had Sabbaths where the buffet is gushing with food. We've had Sabbaths where we had enough. I don't think we've never had a Sabbath where we, you know, went without. But every Sabbath, everyone, I come away from here so satisfied. I'm so grateful to you, sisters, to invest your hearts in us and your souls in us by presenting these dishes to us. I'm going to talk for a little bit about dodgy courtships. Yeah, you're going to be challenged today. Dodgy courtships. See that image there? It's a painting called The Proposal. Now, for all these images, I do the attribution at the bottom of the slide. If you want to know where it came from. So there's a man who's obviously in love. He's proposing to a girl. There's something missing in that picture. I want to see if you can guess what it is. Okay, I'll come back to that in a little bit. But there's a scenario I have seen. I wonder if you have seen this. Boy and a girl hit it off, and the girl drags the boy to her parents. She says, I want you to meet this guy. He's my boyfriend. And he might say, I want to go out with your daughter. And the parents say something like this, whatever makes my daughter happy, I'm all for it. And I know I'm hamming it up like they got, yeah, like they need shoulder pads, right? Whatever makes my daughter happy, I'm all for it. But have you ever seen this scenario where you had a boy meets girl situation and the parents don't show any interest, no wisdom, no insight? No boundaries. Who knows? Maybe they're anxious to get rid of their daughter. Who knows? I'm going to talk about housing applications. Yeah, I'm pretty good at filling out paperwork. I've helped myself and other people fill out paperwork for housing applications, guardianship, power of attorney, other things. I'm real good at that. I scan it into Adobe. I got a professional version of Adobe. I straighten out the document and I type everything in. And when my friends present housing applications and it's all neat and four square, it enhances the application. But I did some checking. There's a whole heap of stuff these landlords want today. Pay stubs. Can you afford this place? Now, by the way, that's an image of the Callaway Villa in Holt Summit. A number of saints have lived there. Very clean, well-run place. But when you're doing a housing application, they'll want to see pay stubs. They want to see bank statements. Proof of identification. Who are you anyway? They want recommendations. You know, in Yahweh's economy, you'll see this in the Bible. People come with commendations from each other. It's like a network of recommendations at work. These landlords want to see vehicle registration and proof of insurance. What, are you going to move in here and turn the parking lot into a used car lot? What if your car blows up? Where's the insurance for this? Social Security number. That's typically the basis for other investigations they'll do. Rental history. Where else have you rented? I have a theory. Let me tap the brake. I have a theory. I believe that half of the landlords in this country are liars. It's just a theory. I could be wrong. But let's think about this. Suppose I'm a landlord. I've been a landlord four times across two properties. And suppose I have horrible tenants. I mean, horrible, horrible tenants. They haven't paid any rent. They put a swimming pool in the bedroom. They drilled holes in the floor so the plants in the basement can grow through it. Okay, just terrible tenants. The kids have turned the wall into a canvas for their crayons. I got to get rid of these terrible tenants. And so another landlord calls me. He said, hey, I just got an application from that family living with you. They said you would give them a reference. Were they good tenants? Now, you see, I want to get rid of this bunch. And at that moment, I'm going to be tempted to lie and say, oh, yeah, they're on time with the rent. They're just a wonderful family. I'm going to be tempted to lie. Well, it turns out I have found evidence of this on the internet that their landlord just said, man, I had to lie to get these people off my land. Landlords are scared to death of taking on tenants who don't fulfill their part of the agreement. Job history, resume, what kind of work do you do? Do you have steady work? They want to know about pet information. Are you going to move in and have a zoo there? How about a checkbook? You know, if their rent deposit is check number 0001, that's going to look fishy, isn't it? And a credit report. Have you been paying your bills? These are serious things that applicants have to submit often. There might be a few here that they skip, but this is a pretty good snapshot of what people have to do to demonstrate that they are worthy to rent the place they're seeking. Let's go back to dodgy courtships. We have situations where men presume to touch the heart of a daughter of Abraham, and you're the parents of these kids. Don't you think your daughter is worth more than a mere apartment in town? Isn't that kind of an easy economy to figure out? Here we got landlords in town who want to know everything. They want to know everything about you. They've asked for everything but x-rays. But people are going into lifetime relationships and they don't know anything about each other. Do you have to wait until you're married to find out your partner's a homosexual and doesn't intend to stay married? How about getting married and you find out they're $88,000 in debt? Maybe other things, criminal history? Who knows? Yeah, I hope to scare you. I know I speak for a lot of people in my generation. I know this with certainty. Many of us have had it. We've had it with ill-conceived relationships. I asked you what was missing in that photograph, that image there. It's a old painting. I'll tell you what's missing. The parents are missing. I'll tell you a cool story about my dad and my sister. Now, my kid's sister had a different daddy than me. My stepfather was an interstate criminal, a swindler, a womanizer, terrible guy. He was very good at getting women interested in him. That man absolutely destroyed my mother's heart. He's a terrible man. That terrible, evil man who was so charming in the beginning, he left an unredeemable scar in my mother's soul. But my kid's sister formed a relationship with my dad. She started working at his restaurant. Pretty soon she was calling him dad. She put up the Christmas tree in his apartment. He didn't live with us. And over time, she became like a daughter to him. He's walking down the street one day, and my kid's sister came out of a restaurant with a fellow at hand. And my dad saw her. He says, "Hey, who's this guy?" She said, "Oh, that's my boyfriend." My dad said, "Oh, you're dating my daughter, huh?" He said, "Put your hand in your pocket." And he did that. He says, "Okay, I want you to grab all the money in that pocket." And he grabbed it. He says, "Okay, now I want you to pull it out and let me see what you got." My dad looked at it. He said, "You don't have enough money to date my daughter." This may not seem very spiritual. But you see, my dad's ancestry came from Eastern Europe. He knows about hardship, poverty, sorrow. He's divorced too. He knows how many arguments there can be about money. Now, it turns out when my parents broke up, they were pretty prosperous. But you see, my dad was a good provider. He was a very good provider. You know, that fellow at my sister's side, he proved to be a headache. I wouldn't want to get into it now. But if a man presumes to touch the heart of a daughter of Abraham, he's got to know that he's going to keep her and protect her from want. If it's not a spiritual principle, why is it in the Bible? Proverbs 24:27, "Prepare thy work without and make it fit for thyself in the field, and afterwards build thy house." Some guy presumes to take the heart of a daughter of Abraham. He should have a field. It's very reasonable to ask him, "What field do you work in?" I know it's talking in the Bible about an agricultural field, but spiritually it's a dead bullseye. What field are you working in? How are you going to pay your bills? How are you going to keep my daughter from want? Now, in a properly structured courtship, here's how it's supposed to go. If everything's ideal, I know I'll explain non-ideal cases, but a man should first go to the parents. Instead of awakening the girl's heart, pulling the pin on the hand grenade like that, he should go to the girl's parents and say, "I've been praying about this, and I have reason to believe there'll be a blessing if your daughter and I get together. I want to make sure that you're comfortable with this, that you bless this. If you have any advice for me, if you feel that this is not a good idea, I'll defer to your judgment, but I'm not going to make a move until I get your approval." You know, if a man did a thing like that, immediately he distinguishes himself. What? This guy would restrain himself if I, her parents, would say no? Already a man distinguishes himself. He would say, "I want to convince you that this is a serious matter to me. I want to tell you about where I'm going to be employed and my chosen trade or profession. I want to talk about the plans I have, the preparation I've made so that I can enter into this thing as a responsible human being." The dad will try to discern whether this man really can keep his daughter from want and harm. The mom, she'll be discerning whether this fellow is mature enough to uphold the emotional side of the bargain. There's probably more because I've never played a role in this, but talking to people, interviewing people, doing research, that's how it typically should go. And you parents have supernatural power for discerning this stuff. If you as a woman resent a fact that a man would go to your parents first, you actually have a problem. I know a guy in the faith who flew all the way to Venezuela to get the daddy's approval. Because he treasured her. He valued her. He put time, energy, and research into this. And when you invest time, energy, honor, dignity, respect, you're building a foundation. I want to put a word of encouragement out there for those of you who've been visited by poverty. I want you to stop thinking short term. I want you to think 3 and 4 generations into the future. One of the reasons you should think 3 and 4 generations into the future is because that's how Yahweh thinks. If you want to be successful in this country, I know this is going to be kind of painful, but it's actually kind of easy to be successful in this country. What I'm about to tell you is so well known. All you have to do is finish high school. Don't make babies until you're married. And develop a skill that you can get people to pay you for. That's all it takes. And you'll get by. There's benefits to not being rich, I should tell you. But anyway, the rich think several generations ahead. Today's happy-go-lucky American, go-go American, he thinks about the weekend. That's what he's into. What are we going to do this weekend? What are we going to do? What are we going to do? It has been said that the rich stay rich by acting poor and the poor stay poor by acting rich. What are you squandering your money on? How are you laying a foundation for the future? When the parents size up this boy who wants to go out with their daughter, they want to know, is this guy going to, with maturity, building a future life, building up treasures that he can use to create a sense of security for him and his wife? Or is he still fiddling around with baseball cards? Where's this guy's mind at? Let's talk about Isaac and Rebecca. Much is made of this story, and rightfully so, but I think I have reason to believe some of you have looked at it wrong. My apologies if you already know about what's important here. Isaac's mother died. He was downcast. He still hadn't found a wife. Abraham recruited his faithful assistant, Eliezer, to go find a wife for him. And Eliezer went back to the homeland, and he prayed for a woman of character. Let me go back. He prayed for a woman of character. Now, a lot of people focus on the fact that he asked for a sign. And it's an inspiring story. Frankly, I don't think anybody in this room has the courage to tell somebody else to go find a marriage partner for them. I don't know if anybody in my space has ever said to another person, you go find a wife for me, or you go find a husband for me. Right. So Eliezer is really on the spot. There was nothing in it for him. But he said in his prayer, when I ask this girl for water, the woman that you've appointed, I'll know it's her because she's going to also offer to water the camels. Now, I want you to imagine in the old days where they had service stations and a guy would come out with a tie, you know, and pump your gas. Suppose you asked him, hey, could you put some water in my radiator? He said, sure, let me wash your car too. That would be kind of a surprise, or kind of unusual. That's what happened here. He said, Yahweh, if it's the right one, I want her to offer to water the camels. If you go earlier in the story, he came with 10 camels. You know how much water camels drink? These are desert animals, okay? They take you long distances in the desert. 10 of them loaded down with treasures. He wanted a woman who was generous, gracious, attentive, and serving. If you focus too much on the sign, and I really don't, I recommend people live their lives by signs, omens, and fleeces. I really don't recommend that. But if you focus on what he asked for, this makes a lot of sense. He wanted a woman of character. 10 camels loaded with treasure. This was evidence of Isaac's treasures. You know, as soon as he met her, like shortly after that, he put jewelry on her, gold jewelry. Look it up. So she brought him home, and her dad realized she's going to be secure with Isaac. Now, these Old Testament stories don't check all the boxes for us. When we come to New Covenant theology, we find the need for a woman to be emotionally supported by her husband. But what we have here is plenty. You see, these things, the treasure and the camels and the gold and the jewelry, these are evidence of Isaac's industriousness. What, do you think he just hung around the tent all day? He helped Dad with that little empire they had. Abraham was a prosperous man. And he was a good man. He was able to summon everybody in his clan and the servants. He summoned all of them to wage war against Babylon. Look it up. Isaac was part of that, part of the family business. He was an industrious man. Rebekah would be safe with him. And that meant a lot. That means a lot to any dad. It's a simple formula in this treasure chest theology I'm imparting to you. That image there on the side, that's a pharmacy grade scale made by a company called Torbal for torsion balance. As you contemplate the relationships you're going into, you're going to be weighing things out. How much do I want to put into this project, this relationship, this scheme? Here's the rule I'm urging upon you. The more intimacy you and I presume to establish, the more we will have to know about each other. It's a very simple formula. Stop and think. If the company you're working for, I mean, if you're going to give so many hours a week to this company, what's it going to be like to work for them? They're sizing you up. The relationships you build, the assemblies you join. You know, if somebody has a certain kind of spiritual need and they come here to YRM, they say, guys, there's something I need that I can't find here. I feel Yahweh's leading me to another assembly, and they leave in goodwill. That's okay. They may come back in a spirit of goodwill. Because people, you know, they have certain needs and they want to make sure they can be filled. Right now we have a lot of kids here. There's a time we didn't have so many kids, but we stuck with it. Some people are coming so their children have a place to weave themselves into and grow. We've had people come here from all corners of the country. I'm not sure about Florida, but all the other corners of the country we've had people come from. But if we're going to establish intimacy financially, I got to see a lot of records, you know. Well, if we're going to go with financial intimacy, I want to see financial security. If we're going to do spiritual intimacy, I want some spiritual security. Now, we see some of that in the qualifications for elders. Mm-hmm. We have the Matthew 18 process to redirect brethren and reorder their priorities and maybe kick them out if they're out of order. But if we're going to have spiritual intimacy, we got to make sure that you're on board and you're clean and there's security in that, and emotional intimacy. So many times people enter into lifetime covenant, marriage, and they put demands on the other person that they could never fulfill. Fantasies and hidden demands, hidden agendas. I'm thinking right now of a lovely family back east, a really fine couple. Their charitable deeds are legendary. They got pulled into some guy who pretended to be in the same religion. And, you know, people can come in, they use Hebrew words, Hebrew names. They might grumble a little bit about Western European Christianity, and you'll think, oh, he's one of us. This lovely family back east got mixed up with this guy, and he pulled them into a fraudulent real estate deal. It was absolutely devastating. If they had done the things I'm talking about there, they said, wait, you want us to go into this deal with you? We want to see everything. Who are you? Where'd you come from? Just like the housing application. Where are your treasures at? What's the record of you managing your treasures? Are you creating adequate treasures for the future? For those you serve and love. Okay, we're coming to the end here pretty soon. If I was to take Yahshua's words and pull them out of context, you would rightfully criticize me. And so now we're going to talk about treasures in heaven. Because Yahshua's remarks about that are in a larger context. Lay not up for, it's in Matthew 6:19-21. Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth where moth and rust do corrupt and where thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt and where thieves do not break through nor steal. For where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be also. Now the image there is it's a helicopter nighttime image of two burglars. You know, in these remarks here of Yahshua, he's telling you that he's not going to protect you from burglars. He's not going to protect you from moth and rust. Let's talk about some treasures the Bible talks about. Isaiah 33:6, and wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy times and strength of salvation. The fear of Yahweh is his treasure. Excuse me. It is a treasure before Yahweh if you fear him. I know there's some debate about whether that fear is a dreaded fear or whether it's simply a deep respect. It turns out, wherever you land on that debate, you should be dreadfully afraid of breaking off the relationship. You should be scared out of your mind of that. It appears that's what Yahshua was afraid of when he prayed in the garden. Many men faced execution under Roman rule, commonly called crucifixion. Many men went through that. What was Yahshua afraid of? Because he suffered separation from his father. Separation from Yahweh is the worst thing. I'll bet several times a year we have people call the office and say, hey, I think I committed the unpardonable sin. It's a scary thing. It's good to be scared about that. That's a treasure before Yahweh. But the greatest treasure you can give Yahweh, before we talk about this business of laying up treasures in heaven, let's get this straight. The greatest thing you can give him is obedience. That is the greatest treasure. This quote from Mark 12:33 is actually the words of a scribe. He's having a conversation with Yahshua. And this is what the guy says. He says, and to love him, Yahweh, with all the heart, with all the understanding, and with all the soul, and with all the strength, and to love his neighbor as himself, is more than whole burnt offerings and sacrifices. And when he said this, Yahshua approved what he said. There's other verses I could cite, but I chose that one because the scribe got it. And I'll show you why I'm convinced obedience comes first. I want to thank Brother Wilcar for convincing me of this. If we go to Matthew 19:21, let's have that incident where the rich guy approached Yahshua and he says, hey, what do I do to have eternal life? And he said, keep the commandments. And the guy says, well, which ones? And Yahshua started rattling them off. Now, I think my interpretation is that Yahshua was tabulating commandments and the guy interrupted him. I think that's what happened because it's just such a short list. The guy says, wait, I've done all that. And Yahshua said unto him, if thou wilt be perfect, go and sell that thou hast and give to the poor and thou shalt have treasure in heaven and come and follow me. So he's telling the guy, look, sell what you have, give to the poor, give everything you got to the poor and you give yourself to me. But it's significant that Yahshua told him this after establishing the rich man's obedience. And you have to have a theology that allows a poor man to get in on the game. The greatest treasure you can give Yahweh is your obedience. That's got to come first. You can't have a theology that says, oh, I laid up treasures in heaven, I can go sin now. How many people knew that Al Capone, the famous gangster in Chicago, he ran a soup kitchen? How many people know that? It ain't going to count for a thing. There's a legendary story. Well, legend sounds like it didn't happen. There's a story you can access of one of his opponents in the criminal world. He invited the guy to his home and fed him a luscious meal. He showed him great generosity, a luscious meal. Then he got out a baseball bat and beat him to death. I drove past that home twice. It's in the Gresham District. For those of you who are acquainted with Chicago, it's a house. I would never want to live there. But no, you can't say, well, I had a soup kitchen, so I can sin over here. The greatest treasure you can give Yahweh is your obedience. That's your starting point. But if you'll be perfect, you get into these other realms of laying up treasures in heaven. We have another account in Matthew 10:21. Then Yahshua, beholding him, loved him, because he said, I kept these commandments from my youth. It says, one thing thou lackest, go thy way, sell whatever thou hast, and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven. And come, take up the gallows, and follow me. Now, this account slips in there the fact that this can be a hard life. Again, he tells him this after we established his obedience. We have the same thing in Luke 18:22. I'm not going to read it. But now we have three places in the evangels where this story, everybody who's read the evangels now seen this. There's another one. I didn't expect this in my research. I didn't expect so much evidence of this, so much emphasis. Luke 12:32-34, Yahshua says, fear not, little flock, for your Father's good pleasure is to give you the kingdom. Sell that you have and give alms. Provide yourself bags which wax not old, a treasure in the heavens that faileth not, where no thief approaches, neither moth corrupteth. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. So we're seeing now a cloud of witnesses on something that has priority before heaven, where you're going for the gold. Okay, I've got obedience in hand. How can I go for the gold? Now, for these last several slides, I have an image there, a famous image of the altar of burnt offering being as part of the destruction of Jerusalem. We have a print of that painting down in the lower lobby, the lower hallway downstairs. I just found out this is actually considered the most valuable image on the internet or something like that, the most valuable image available online. It's a very famous image. But I've included these to show that the sacrifices and the bloody sacrifices and the burnt offerings are not as important as obedience. They're not as important as laying up treasures in heaven. And that system is gone. This is now a heart-based religion. So we have these four passages that target the poor. Matthew 19:21, Mark 10:21, Luke 12:32-34, Luke 18:22. But there's more. Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar to give to the poor. You can look it up. When Nebuchadnezzar told Daniel his dream, Daniel hit the panic button because he had a certain fondness for the guy, and he didn't like, I think he had the wisdom to know that if you destabilize your government, it's bad for the country. And he said, establish your righteousness by giving to the poor. And that's why in the Jewish economy, the word tzedakah is used for alms. It even shows up in the Shem Tov Hebrew Matthew, where Yahshua says, do your alms in private. The Hebrew Matthew says tzedakah. Do your tzedakah in private, your righteousness in private. I saw a beggar on Devon Avenue, the Jewish neighborhood in Chicago. It's very rare to see a beggar in the Jewish community. But he was stranded in America, having visited from overseas. And he was standing out there by a parking meter. He was saying, tzedakah, tzedakah. So based on this passage in Daniel, you see the connection between righteousness and helping the poor. Paul, when he visited the Jerusalem team of apostles, they agreed to help the poor. This was in Galatians 2:10. The prayers and alms of Cornelius came up as a memorial. We only have a handful of memorials in the Bible. Yahweh's name is a memorial. The Sabbath is a memorial. The Passover is a memorial. And the prayers and alms of Cornelius are a memorial. Here's another memorial for you. There's actually quite a study of these. Here's another memorial for you. It might tie into today's message. We're told to remember Lot's wife. That's kind of a negative memorial, isn't it? A day will come when we may be called away from everything. Are you going to look back when it all comes down? I'm going to impart to you a strategy. Now, there's a magazine image there. It's a magazine called Afar Magazine. It's for rich people who travel around the world and go to big restaurants and that. This particular issue is dedicated to the good life. Is that where your treasure is? Is your treasure on fancy table restaurants around the world? Is that where your treasure is? Yes, this is the strategy now. I'm going to impart to you. Financial reviews and other records show where your heart is at, to where you're investing your time, your money, other treasures. And I bet most of you figured out by now that this review exercise would be a great forum for getting your financial house in order. Can't get around it. Are you going to force yourself to look at the crazy things you've been buying? Maybe you'll get your financial house in order. But more precisely, this could be an engine for reform through which you build financial freedom. I'm not saying prosperity. Financial freedom. Freedom from debt. Freedom from burdens. See, we have an image there of Lazarus at the stairway of the rich man. But once you have financial freedom, you are then free to lay up treasures in heaven. And that ties in everything we talked about. Because if you're laden down with debt, foolish purchases, sins that cause poverty, you can stop it right now. You say, no, it's going to stop now. Now, right now. No more. No more foolishness. Let's learn from our failures. Let's set our hearts to think long term. What's best for our families? And what's best for this messianic imperative to lay up treasures in heaven? What's the best thing for that? What can we change? What can we realign? I'm certain many of you have already thought about using this as a way of getting your financial house in order, but I'm pushing you farther because that's what Yahshua does. This image here you see on the panel is a little boy in Bangladesh. If you look closely, there's a railway engine in the distance. That engine appears to be going away from him. I can't be sure. But what would possess this orphan boy to sit on a railroad track? Might there be a desire in his heart for that to end? Let me lift your spirit with a couple of stories. Treasures in Heaven, real story number one. I'm going to talk about Sister Jenny in the Kisi district. And my buddy from Kenya is in the back of the room. When I was in the Chicago Fellowship, we had Sister Young Jennifer. I knew her as a teenager. I heard her play the piano. And she always loved Africa. Collected books on Africa. She was an expert on Africa. She had maps of Africa. And she wanted to do missionary work. As she entered adult life, she became a nurse. So she's college educated. And the Chicago Fellowship started sending her to the Kisi district of Kenya to minister there, to the village there. And you have to understand something about Kenya. Brother Wilson can verify this. It's a boiling cauldron of Sabbath keepers there. They're all over the place. And many of them have adopted Yahweh's name. You'll hear them singing in Swahili on Sabbath. And every now and then you'll hear the holy name. It's glorious. It's just glorious. Now, their Sabbath meetings last many hours. Well, the Chicago Fellowship sent her there a number of times. And what happened is she would load up several travel bags with clothes. Now, they wanted to stretch their dollars. So the Chicago Brethren, they would go to Goodwill and Salvation Army and buy clean clothes that were in good condition and pack those bags on real heavy. I'm telling you, that luggage was bigger than her. And she had a letter from the president of the company, the airline, saying she could check all those heavy bags. And one time we asked her, what's it like when you show up with all those clothes? Because she came as a nurse. And over there at that time, a nurse was like having a doctor come. And she described how it goes when she opens up the luggage with those clothes. Those kids are squealing and shrieking and crying. So happy to have functional, clean clothes. Sister Jenny's dad was not in the faith. He went there once. He came back. He said, if you go there, you become far more grateful for what you have. These people are so happy with so little. And here we are, fat and spoiled, materialistic. He said he needed that visit. He needed to go there and see that. Others have reported that too. What have we become? It's a small world, a big Elohim, isn't it? Sister Jenny and her clan, many of them moved to Sterling, Illinois, and joined that fellowship. I got a call from Jenny late one night, a cold winter night in Chicago, and she asked me to sponsor her fiancé to come to America. I'm not an expert on immigration, but I know more than most. He came in on some kind of betrothal visa or engagement visa, something like that. And he stayed with me as they pursued a real courtship. Her daddy flew to Africa to talk to the tribal elder about this. It was, I won't say it's an arranged marriage, but the meeting was arranged. And they hit it off. You see, the elder's son was also college educated, and he had a hard time finding someone like him in the village. And Sister Jenny was the best match, was a great match. Oh, they've downloaded a number of beautiful kids. Maybe you can think back a week ago. Can you think back a week ago? Remember we had, oh my goodness, do we still have one of those relatives here? Oh, anyway, we had a girl here leading in song on Friday evening, Yerev Shabbat. That was Jennifer's daughter, Eliah, and her brother James. I was in the vestibule there around back, resting on the couch. I didn't want it to end. She sang it like a nightingale. I feel so privileged to be part of that story. Here's a picture of Elder Duane in the Kisi village. I had to work hard to find this picture because Elder Duane from Shalom Assembly is pretty active out there. But this is the Kisi district. If you look closely on the right, you'll see a couple of the guys who visited us for Tabernacles a few years ago. It's a small world and it's a big Elohim. If you ever have that experience where you have a missionary come back and tell you what goes on, about the bullseye that you hit, there's a sensation that comes along like, hey, let's do more of this. And this has been my experience. When you get in on the game, Yahweh gets in on the game. Resources start to show up that you didn't know were there. Whether you're starting a ministry like here or doing missionary work, when you do Yahweh's work, when you get in on his game, Yahweh gets in on the game. And it's way more interesting than computer games. It's far more satisfying. Treasures in Heaven, story number 2. I read this in one of the Sabbath magazines in the 1970s. I don't know which one. I put them both up there. It was either the Bible Advocate or the Sabbath Sentinel. This fellow was describing in the article how he resented the money he sent to the missionary. I don't know where the mission was, but the outcome was important. Through his high school years and entering adult life, he often resented the large amounts of money he sent there to build the school. And he finally got a chance to go to the mission center. He talked about how he got out of the vehicle, and once again, them kids. They surrounded him. They knocked him to the ground, hugging him, kissing him, touching him, shouting their appreciation for the school he helped them build. That's treasure chest theology. That's the payoff. Whether it be the widow's mite, whether it be helping the ministry here, ministry work, all kinds of ways of investing in heaven, Joshua put an emphasis on the poor, and I can understand that. Let me summarize my remarks. We're almost done here. Jose, you can get yourself ready to come back up. If stopping sin is your top priority, lots will have to change in your life. And that's what you promised in the waters of baptism. You can know your own heart by simply reviewing financial and other records which are already under constant review from data brokers now. They know where your heart's at. Why don't you go find out where your heart's at? Next, you can use these practical resources to assess the people who lay claim to your time, your soul, your spirit, your assets, your family. You want to mingle your life with mine? We're going to have to know a lot about each other. You have to do that full disclosure, due diligence stuff. That same exercise enables you to realign your priorities so that you can achieve financial freedom. With financial freedom in hand, I'm going to give you a hint. With financial freedom in hand, a hint. The key is frugality. Everybody who's experienced financial freedom says the key is frugality. With that in hand, you're poised to lay up treasures in heaven, just like Yahshua commands. Okay, Brother Jose, where are you, buddy? Okay, you've been generous with your time. Thank you for your kind attention. Hallelujah.